this
free them
is
from
the book
what?
Report.
School. Most of the schools around me are going full virtual, and mine's not yet.
Our schools are trying to push to go to full in-person again.
Well, yeah, a lot of them are. I know even in New York, that's kind of the thing. So it's not just a dumb Republican plot in the world. It's like a balance, and I understand, it's like a balance of trying to make sure everyone's not in poverty, but also not everyone dying. And that's hard.
One of our school districts decided to do in-school quarantine, which doesn't even make sense on its face. And
that's
no one
not
is
how
taking
quarantine
up
works.
On it. Exactly. It's the dumbest thing anyone's ever heard. So that's fun.
Yeah.
Also, my governor took one of his appointees off of the school board because he opposed, or he was a opponent. He was a proponent of a mask mandate. Mm-hmm. Took him off and tried to replace him with a lady who started a petition to recall her city leadership because they instituted a mask mandate, mm-hmm. and also proudly proclaimed that she quit public schools because they're just indoctrination centers, mm-hmm. and runs only and homeschools all her children. He tried to appoint her to the school board. The entire state flipped out, and then he rescinded. She asked to have the nomination rescinded, and he, you know, acquiesced. And in his letter, he said, because the Dems won't refuse to allow an appointee that won't bow to their political whims. And it's like, you removed one of your own appointees because he wouldn't bow to your political whims.
Yeah.
What is this nonsense?
All politicians are corrupt. I know that the common thing to say is eat the rich, but I really think we should eat the politicians first and see what happens then. Because
most of them
most
are the rich,
problems.
So let's do it.
They're not as rich as like the rich people want to eat. Like, you don't go into politics if you've got billions of dollars. You go into it if you've got hundreds of thousands, and you just want power.
And you want
also, real quick, I don't know if you can hear this, but this is the sound of a teacher on a Tuesday. That was a beer cracking open.
I love it. Also, tell me if there is a dog. There's an AT&T truck the street behind mine, and a dog I've never heard bark at anything before, two houses down, has been going insane since I sat down to start recording. Hopefully we're talking over it and you can't hear it, but I can hear it and it's driving me nuts.
I can't hear anything except the beautiful carbonation on this alcohol.
That's good, because it is literally, one frustration more on a day full of insane, ridiculous frustrations. So I might kill a dog today.
It's all good. I agree with today being frustrating. My school, since we can't really do anything normally, decided to do their Saturday school after school. Do you know what the last thing in the world anyone wants to do at the end of a long day of teaching? I'll tell you, Joel.
School?
No, it wouldn't even be more school. More school is fine, because a lot of times kids are decent. They're really not that bad. And if you're a teacher, you probably like kids. No, the problem is that Saturday school is all of the kids who hate everything because their parents are jagweeds and raised their kids poorly. And so these kids are poorly socialized, and you're trying to tell them why education's important after they've been in school all day. It's a good way to end the day. Yeah.
I can see how that is infuriating.
Oh, it's actually okay. I just get frustrated that these kids definitely have, like, bad parents.
Yeah, that's
almost
depressing.
That's not depressing. Do you know what's not depressing?
No. I don't know what's not depressing.
I hoped you had something.
I only know depressing
so
things.
Long. You sound like one of the kids who comes into my class. Like, I say, hey, everyone, how's your day going? And yesterday she just went, ugh.
That's how I feel every day.
All right, well, not asking what your opinion is, Susan.
Well, actually, I do have some funny news. I don't know if it's funny. I mean, it's pretty good news. The Supreme Court just rejected even hearing the case to overturn Pennsylvania's election results with not a single dissenter, even of any of Trump's appointees. So there's hope for the future of our country. I don't know. That's something.
Yeah. That's like not that surprising. It's like
it's not surprising at all. I mean, it's slightly surprising, which is depressing. But it's
I think if you get into the Supreme Court, you're at least smart enough to know that if you're going to do something underhanded, You shouldn't do it in such overt ways.
That's true. That's true. One can only hope that that's
smart. But I don't know. I'm clearly not smart enough to be on the Supreme Court. I'm that's a public true. School teacher. And based off my salary, I'm an idiot.
Oh, yeah. Well, you keep running those indoctrination centers.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I did want to talk about that. What do people mean by that? Like, as a teacher, what am I teaching your kid that you're angry about?
I have no idea. I don't understand the points on anything. I sat through a 2.5 hour presentation by the lawyers, that's not a word, by the lawyers for the Board of Education, like the U.S. Board of Education's higher ed team. And they talked for 2.5 hours about this assault on free speech on campuses. And I cannot tell you a single thing that they were talking about. I watched the entire thing and I don't understand it. The end of it, and this is especially infuriating to me, to readers and hopefully listeners to our podcast. The end of it, the man quoted George Orwell's 1984 when he's talking about how the reason other dictatorships and things have failed is because they were a dictatorship for the sake of a cause, or a revolution for the sake of a cause, and theirs is just for the sake of power, and that's why theirs succeeds. And he was somehow relating that to censorship. And I'm like, you picked the wrong apocalyptic book to talk about censorship, A, when Fahrenheit 451 is sitting right there. That is not at all what that quote meant. What'd you say?
I said Fahrenheit 451 isn't there. They set it on fire.
It was baffling. It was the most baffling thing I've ever experienced. And I still have no idea what their point was.
Couldn't tell you. Wasn't there.
Very difficult.
The only indoctrination I can even think of is like on Monday, we always start the day off by sitting the kids in a circle, lighting candles, and sacrificing a goat. But I think that's fine. Okay. Yeah. It's historical. No. You know, I'm opening these kids up to ancient civilizations.
And it's supporting our farmers. Process of
sorcery. Exactly. Old Farmer Joe raises only the best for our sacrificial rituals.
Speaking of political cliches, that's what we are talking about today.
Politics cliches and tropes. Well, so far so good. Seven minutes in, and that's all I've mentioned.
No, we want to talk about we mention them all the time, and I think we kind of had an episode about our favorite and least favorite tropes and cliches, but we want to talk about today the good. We both recently read some things that are really good and really bad uses of very famous tropes, and when we're okay with them and when we're not, and just kind of, we just want to do some trope talking. Trope talk.
It's like tightrope walking. Rope walking.
No, trope talk talking, is definitely.
Rope talking. Rope walking.
Definitely the name of a YouTube channel I watch, so we can't steal that. It's probably copyrighted.
Do people on YouTube copyright? I thought YouTube just kind of like allows you to exist, and then if they think they can, they take it from you?
Man, I don't know. I don't corporate copyright law.
You should. You would make a lot more money than you currently do.
That's very true.
We should like, you could have so many more opinions because you could make your opinions happen. Mm-hmm. It's really the only reason I have money.
Well, one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this is because I just finished, and by just, I mean last week at some point, finished the second book after in the space trilogy, The Dark Forest, and started Death's End. And The Dark Forest is one of the most amazing books I've ever read.
Wait till you get to the next one.
I'm a little bit into it, and I have lots of questions. But
It's an amazing book. I loved it so much.
But one of the things I was flipping out about near the end of the first book is the second book had this setup to where your main character was one of four people on Earth given like ultimate authority and ultimate power. The wall facers. And in any other science
spoilers
fiction,
for those of you who have not yet read these books.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into the details of anything. I'm just like giving basic setups.
Keep going. Just thought I'd throw it out.
Yeah. The trope, the The cliche that would happen in any other sci-fi or any other fantasy book for that reason is if four people are given a special power and one of them is your protagonist, three of them are going to fail miserably and your protagonist is going to succeed. And that's just how especially if there's another book in the series, that's how it has to work. And usually they all fail because of some character flaw. It serves to highlight, you know, the differences between your character and why your character is a protagonist and why he wins and blah, 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 blah. This book utterly like throws it in its face, that trope, because it simultaneously succeeds in it. They all do fail except for the protagonist. And yet they don't fail because of anything they did wrong. They were just outsmarted. Everything they did was intelligent and super smart and would have worked, but the other side
against any other enemy, it would have worked perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Like literally anything except a hyper super genius intelligence that's far beyond our reach.
It's a crazy, and it's not even like, even if you knew the plan in a couple of them, it still would have worked, except that humanity, once they found out about it, wouldn't let them do it. Like, wouldn't let them go through with the plan. And it's just so insane that it's an example of characters doing everything right and being as smart as possible and still losing. And those not being the main characters. And it was just, I loved that reversal. And it got me thinking about all these other times that happens, where you can pace a book and you can tell them broad strokes what the main events are going to be, just based on the introduction, just based on the setup of how things work.
So on that same example, one of the tropes that I really get frustrated with or annoyed with is that when you have a protagonist who is supposed to be just the best, the only way it seems that authors know to counter that person who's almost like the Superman type character is with violence. Like, they bring in someone who can attack them, fight them, beat them at their own game. Mm-hmm. And in this book, I think one of the things that makes it so strong is that that's not what happens, because when the wall facer is shown and then the counterpart, the wall breaker, you think that the climax is going to be the wall facer being killed. That doesn't happen a single time.
Nope.
And that is just incredible. Like, it's never a violent altercation. It's just this calm, rational discussion. And it works so much better. And not to go into any finer details beyond that.
But because you need to read these books. They're way too freaking smart.
It's so incredibly smart. And I almost wonder if one of the reasons it seems so smart is because it's written from outside of our culture. So maybe these ideas are almost... Well, I'm wondering if some of these ideas and ways of writing might be considered tropes in China, but in the United States, they're new and fresh and we've never seen them before.
Which is an interesting that might be true. And that might be, I mean, I've actually, because of these books, started picking up and looking at more foreign written books that have been translated so that I can expand my horizons literally.
And China is an interesting case, and you can see it a lot in this book, because China has this incredibly strong academic tradition that goes back thousands of years. And it really shows a lot through just the layers of thinking and the way that a lot of the plot is set up. I'm really excited for you to read the third book and finish it so we can just
have you finished it already? I'm like two chapters
I honestly almost texted you the second I finished it, but I didn't want to give you anything that could give away.
Don't.
I didn't want to give any part of the book away. Like, I didn't want to describe how I felt at the end, because this needs to be like
that first chapter was raw for you. Like, the whole time I was like, am I reading the wrong book?
I did too. Oh my God. I went online and I Googled what order is the through body problem in, because I was like, oh shit, did I accidentally read book 3 second?
Yeah, I was very thrown for, I knew, like, I had a physical copy and everything, and I was very thrown for the whole first chapter. I was like,
because the whole world thing does disconnect way back in time, and I was like, son of a gun, I did this wrong. I'm an idiot. For those of you who read this book, you didn't do it wrong. It was
it starts out strange, but it's already strange. Crazy interesting. Anyways, before this devolves into just being about those trilogy.
But I want to.
I know, but I need to finish the last one first, and then we can do a full-blown episode on it. But I was another thing that I was thinking about when I was reading this is, and it kind of does this trope in that book, but it does it a lot more in the Dresden Files that we recently talked about, where bad guy and the good guy, or the hero and the main villain, have the exact same powers. And this is every single Marvel movie. This is so many like books where the hero and the villain are two sides of the same coin, and they have the same power set to fight. And that's not how anything works in real life. You're usually battling somebody that does something that has nothing to, like, you, the reason you're battling in the first place is because you don't have the same skills and abilities. And that's something that isn't done very often in text, but the three-body problem, or the blah, blah, blah. Force of the Dead does it a little bit by the end, where we're fighting a space battle against against aliens, and we're doing all the things we can do to make the biggest, baddest space fleet, and they show up with a weapon we couldn't even possibly have thought about because they're not fighting with the same equipment. And right. That's how things would really work. It happens a lot in The Expanse, where one side, and this is how it happens in real life a lot of the times, one side is fighting with ideology and reality, and the other side is fighting with brute force and lies. And you can't actually combat those things very easily, and that's why it evolves into big blown up insanity. And I want to see more of that. Do you have any more examples of that kind of thing, where the heroes and the villains are the exact same, or they're vastly different, and that's why it works better?
Oh man. So I think I can't talk about that because you're currently reading it. I was going to talk about The Wheel of Time because it was the first thing that popped in my mind, but I'm not going to go down that route. I think that vastly different powers, a good example is like Lord of the Rings, right? You have the hobbits versus the immortal Dark Lord. Mm-hmm. That's a huge power disparity. And I think that's why that book works so well.
Yeah, it doesn't come down to a sword fight between two magic users like so many fantasies do.
Exactly. It's just like the power of good triumphs over evil, despite the fact that evil is obviously superior. And a lot of times I like that better. I like the idea that no matter what, good is going to triumph, even though some people find that too boring these days. Whatever. Those people can go die. A book, though, where it's just the same on both levels. Oh, geez. I need to even think about what the last seasons I've read. Because that one is honestly really common.
Yeah, and that's what I feel about. That's why I'm a little bit disappointed that they gave, spoiler alert, they gave Lord Baron Marcone magic powers by the end. Because I'm like, okay, well, that just sets it up to be a wizard battle at the end, when instead it was going to have to be him versus the law, or him versus, I don't know. It just kind of is annoying that it comes back to that.
I agree, because he was such an interesting character when he was just a normal
human. And I understand it in movies. It's more fun and visually appealing, but you don't have to do that in text. Don't resort to that. You can avoid that.
Yeah. I think that a book that has the same power disparity, or the same like level in all of them, and these aren't necessarily, I mean, they are books, but people don't always know them that way, would be the James Bond novels. Because realistically, James Bond is always set up to be a character who is like fighting against all odds. But in reality, he has like the backing and training of the British government, which is still kind of in its heyday when he's coming around. And so the people, like, what's really interesting about the James Bond novels is that it seems like the bad guy is way better and bigger than James Bond, but in reality, it's almost reversed, because the villain is actually the lone going against the entire government type person. And it's James Bond who's actually like an agent of the government. But it's presented in such a way that you think, oh, these guys are evenly matched. And they're fun to read, but they're not necessarily like morally interesting books to read. You're not going to get much out of them other than, oh, that was a cool fight. The Marvel movies are all, the reason the reason that Marvel is turning itself into the modern version of the spaghetti western is because they're just trying to make each successive villain bigger and badder and bigger and badder and bigger and badder. And you can't do that because eventually you're just going to end up with an omnipotent god. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a hero that's an omnipotent god to fight an omnipotent god.
And then there's no struggle
anymore. There's no point. It's yeah. boring. It's super yeah. boring.
Well, I have another topic I want to talk about, or not topic, but another trope I want to talk about, but I wanted to see if you had any before I jump to my next one. These are good or badly used.
So I think that the love triangle is a good one just to mention since we're talking okay. about tropes. So what are your thoughts on using a love triangle in a book to kind of drive the tension of the plot?
I am okay with it as long as it isn't, as long as it's used in the right context, because if you have a love triangle in a teenage superhero or, rebellion story, that's very cliche at this point, but it also, it's cliche for a reason. And that love triangle and those kinds of emotions are what drive teenage thought. So as long as it's not done just for the sake of having a love triangle in your book, I think it's okay. But, and as long as it's resolved in a way that doesn't make me hate you, I think that should actually be that's my first point, not my second point. Because way too often, and I'm thinking in particular of The Hunger Games, the way that love triangle resolved infuriated me because it was like, I don't know, it was so much. I hope everyone's listening has read or seen the Hunger Games movies. That love triangle was so good in the first two books. It actually made sense that she had to have this public persona where she was in love with someone, and then it slowly started becoming real, whereas her real emotions before she became famous were for somebody else, and then it started getting pulled in two different directions. That whole thing worked so beautifully, and then for the last book, which is, oh, well, I guess we're going to kill somebody and make him kind of a terrorist before the end so that everyone's okay with her falling for this guy. I was like, no, just make her actually come to a decision. Make her I hate you.
Yeah.
Don't make one of them evil so that you can get away with your love triangle ending the way you wanted it to end. Make it work. Make it make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. It's not very nice of your author to decide for you. It's like if your protagonist is trying to decide between marrying the hopeless romantic who's a painter or marrying the industrialist who's making millions, and then it turns out that the painter is Hitler. Like,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, there's no sexual tension now, is there?
Just resolve it. Like,
yeah.
I know that's hard, and that's some of the hardest things people have to do in real life is
agreed.
Make decisions figure about out. Who they love and who they want to be with. And obviously we need that well reflected in our fiction, and instead they just have an easy that person died or that person's now evil. So choice is made for you. That's not how it's just dumb.
I agree with you because I imagine there are a lot of high schoolers or younger who have had at least the problem of, do I ask Cindy or do I ask Shirley to go to the prom? You know, it's right. not necessarily oh my God, who do I love? It's just, wow, both of them are my friends. They're both pretty. And it's
I don't want to hurt anyone, but I also like one person more kind of thing.
Exactly. And when you are a young person, there really isn't much that matters more to you. That does seem it is the biggest deal on the planet.
So give young people some tools to actually figure out how to work through that instead of just killing one of them or making them Hitler.
Yeah. That's fair.
The book that Hannah Bingham Bruner came on talk about in Other Lands. Actually, it was in Other Lands. That was one of the ones she mentioned. It has that kind of moment in it a couple times with a couple different people where they're just I don't want to hurt somebody's feelings, but I don't actually have feelings for them. and how do I deal with that? Yeah. And they actually get through it. Like they deal with it. But also the main love affair does just kind of solve itself instead of having any kind of it's a little better. It's not one of them ends up evil. They all end up friends again by the end, but it does resolve itself instead of the main character having to work through it. But he does work through it a couple other times in the story. So it's a little column A, a little column B. It's like, you can't get it all right.
Fair enough. So the reason I asked is because I think that you have to have one of two routes when you're writing a romance in a book or even a TV show. I think you either need to have two characters that are not going to end up together until very, 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 very late on in the series, just to kind of have like something to talk about. Or you need to have a love triangle to kind of pull them in different directions, because when you have two characters that are together all the time, it's honestly really, really annoying to read about. And just think through the conversations that you have with a significant other. They are not conversations that are interesting to anybody else on the planet. They are boring. They're dull. They're probably pretty stupid. You both think that it's really funny and no one around you is laughing. And we all recognize that.
Yeah.
One of the books,
it's not compelling at all.
It's not. It's really, really boring. That's why everyone makes fun of married people and says, oh, well, you're married. That sucks. Like, there's a reason for that. It's because once you get married, it's really great for the people who are in that relationship, but it's really but boring.
Wants to watch that.
Yeah. No one cares. There's no drama.
There's no drama, zero drama, no conflict. Yeah.
Exactly. And so one of the books I was thinking about when I asked this question, you haven't read any more of The Demon Cycle, have you, by Peter V. Brett?
No.
Beyond Book One? Yeah. So in either...
Well, actually, I'm a little bit into the second book.
Okay. So I think it's in book two, the main character, Arlen Bales, he ends up with someone, and I wish they would have put him in a love triangle, because instead he ends up with someone, and they just end up, like, everything they say is, love you, Arlen Bales, love you too, insert name. And I'm not kidding. That's literally a line that is repeated probably 40 or 50 times in the book.
Yeah.
He says, love you. And she says, love you. And it's like gag inducing. It's so boring. It's like, great, you're married. Please go away from each other so things start happening again. And so I really think that that book would have been really like benefited by just throwing a third person in there to cause some tension and some conflict.
Right. Right.
Because no one really reads books
for the happy, best. Yeah.
No one reads it like you read a textbook. Like, I'm not reading it to find out, like, oh, okay, so this world has 38.6 cubic tons of gold. Like, you read it for the tension.
Yeah.
You want the bad, the drama.
Without conflict, without moments, there's what's the point of your story? Without that, you're reading poetry.
Yeah.
You're reading, which, okay, poetry has its place, or a textbook has its place, but that's not what fiction is. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even poetry has some conflict. Two roads diverged in the yellow wood. He didn't say, there was a road. I took it.
Fair. Good point.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know one of your least favorite tropes you always talk about is the it's two in one, kind of. It's the farm boy grows up to slay the big monster in a fantasy book because he's, you know, long lost royalty of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's both those two together, or one of the two, that happens in every fantasy story.
Bro, can I say something real quick about that trope?
Yeah.
Fuck that trope. Continue.
Okay. But there are times when it happens that you don't hate it. Obviously, those times are usually one of the first times they're used.
Right.
For instance, Lord of the Rings, you know, Return of the King. It's all about how, you know, I almost called him Viggo Mortensen.
It's fine. Hey, Viggo Mortensen is Aragorn forever. If they ever recast that, I'm boycotting.
Right. So, but Aragorn is a, you know, long lost king. And for all intents and purposes, Frodo is a farm boy. And then in The Wheel of Time, your main character so far is a sheep herder who wants to go on, who's about to go on to fight whatever. But these things were written so long ago that the tropes are based off of them. Like, they are the reason for them. And one of the things I recently learned is that that's the case a lot of the time, that tropes become so ingrained because of one super popular book that we don't even realize that it's not that much of a trope. Because I can't, I can think of only a few times that there's actually the farm boy happens to be the long lost king in fantasy books. I can think of it in Star Wars, but again, that's like a movie that set the stage. And then I can think of like all the things that ripped off of Star Wars, like the Aragorn series.
Sure.
Otherwise, I can't think of a lot where that specific thing happens.
And a lot of times they'll use elements of it. So right. I don't know if you've ever read the Prydian Chronicles by Lloyd Alexander, but they start off with, this is the Black Cauldron series.
I was like, I've heard that name before.
Yeah. So they start off with the main character. His name's Taryn, and he is like literally a pig farmer. And you're like, oh God, this guy's going to be the king of all the world. That doesn't happen. But they use the element of, oh, this is just like a little farm boy living in the middle of nowhere. And I think the reason that specific trope is used is because it's very easy to experience a wider world full of wonder when you start them off at zero.
Yeah, right? You get to make the main everything character your audience stand in.
Yeah, everything is interesting when you've never experienced anything. So, right. You know, but...
And it's the cliche hero's journey. It's really easy to build on that.
Exactly. But I think you're really right, because even right now I'm struggling to think of that many books where you take a farm boy and put him on the throne. Because, you know, like, generally speaking, that doesn't happen because of the dynamics going on. Like, normally it's more common for the farm boy to end up fighting the king and overthrowing
him
than it is for him to actually be like the long-lost
prince, whatever.
Orphaned, whatever. Right.
Yeah. I thought of this one because I was reading something and it talked about how, you know, the cliche, the butler did it. In all of Western fiction, there's like maybe a handful of times that the butler is actually the person who did it in a mystery novel, but it all comes from a super popular mystery novel back at the turn of the century. It wasn't even an Agatha Christie novel. It was surprising. Prior to Agatha Christie. I can't even remember the name of the novel they were talking about, but it kind of started the mystery genre, and the butler did it in that one, and then that became a cliche, even though it barely ever happened again.
Huh. Well, that's interesting.
And that makes me think of, like, what other things do we call cliches that don't actually happen all that much?
That is a good question. So the butler did it is a good one. The farm boy becomes the king is a good one. Okay. Ooh, this is all I want to do now. Opening up, like, a secret tomb causes a curse to ruin the world.
Right. Does that happen anywhere but the Pharaoh movie or the not Pharaoh the
like the Mummy?
Mummy movies?
Yeah, I don't know that it does. Like, that's kind of
like they keep say that's going to happen in Tomb Raider, but obviously the world never gets in danger really. Mm-hmm.
No, nothing really ever happens. Unless I guess if you count Pandora's box.
Yeah, I think that's really like tomb, that's the beginning like of the it. Original, yeah.
Maybe there aren't as many tropes as we think there are. Ooh. Maybe artists are all original thinkers. They're not. No, they're really not. What's that line?
All artists steal, the great ones do it outright.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. One of my favorites.
Yeah.
Well, I want to keep thinking of those if you come up with any more.
Yeah, we'll come around to it. I don't want to spend too much time on it.
But I am halfway, maybe a little bit more through of the first book of The Wheel of Time. And one thing that I found myself loving is that the whole first book is the reverse of my favorite thing to happen in anything. And it's my favorite thing in all movies, books, TV shows, musicals, whatever, is the converging of several different storylines and plots and everything into one. I love that moment in everything. And so this book is the inverse of that. It's all the characters start out together and you're slowly separating them and they're getting more and more splintered as the book goes on. And it's so interesting because, I mean, obviously there's like 16 books or something in this series, and you can tell that it's not going to be a moment where they're all going to come back together. I mean, it might, but it's going to be more of like kind of closer to real life as they're going to split up and they're going to sometimes interact with each other later on, but it doesn't look like there's going to be a moment where they all come back together again. And that makes me happy for some reason, even though it's the opposite of what I normally want to happen in a fantasy novel. So I thought it was a weird inversion of the trope.
So I think that's one of the things that Robert Jordan did really well. He put everyone together at the beginning, and then as he developed his books, he gave each person their specific sphere of influence, and he allowed each of those persons to develop that sphere of influence organically. And it's really cool to see how he does that, because it's I think one of the problems that most books have is that you get a very limited view of the world. Like to an extent, Lord of the Rings has this problem, and you know, Brandon Sanderson has this problem, but you just have this telescope fixated on one specific part of the world. And Robert Jordan does this amazing job where he starts with this ensemble cast and then throws them to every corner of the world so that you can simultaneously see what's happening everywhere at once. And you get this really cool tapestry that starts to like bleed into each other and build out this world. And he even does this really cool thing that I like, where every once in a while, the main characters will walk into a tavern and Robert Jordan will just kind of go off on a soliloquy of all of the rumors that are spurting around. And the rumors will be like either dead on, mixed in with like some that are like partially true, mixed in with some that are really, really off, but maybe could be right. And it's just this really, really interesting way that he takes all these different storylines and weaves them together. It's one of the best things about the series for all of the faults that it has. I do like that quite a bit.
Yeah. I found myself somewhere at the point where, and spoiler, for a very old book, where, the guy who can hear or talk to wolves, somewhere where he starts like early on in the chapters where he meets them and he starts like, fighting or refusing to admit that he can hear the wolves. It's like, oh, he's going to end up staying with this wolf person. And then I started putting all the two and two together. I was like, oh, they're not going to get back together. This group is splitting up completely. And that's what this series is going to be. And I was like, that's awesome. Because that's normally the exact opposite normally happens at the end of the first book is you get your band together. Nope. You broke your band up like a quarter of the way into your first book.
That's cool. I didn't realize that storyline started in the first book. His name's Perrin, right?
P-E-R-R-I-N. I don't know. I'm so bad with the names.
No, that's okay. So overall, before we go into the next tropes, what are your overall impressions of The Wheel of Time so far? I know you have a limited scope of reference.
Yeah. I was going to say originally too many characters. It's so hard to keep them all straight. Especially the way I'm doing it is I'm audiobooking it and I have it on Kindle, so I'm like listening to it as I run the dogs and then reading some more at night, and the juxtaposition of that just keeps throwing me off. But now that they're all being, you know, differentiated, that's I'm fine with that.
I think there's only three men and two women that you actually have to keep track of through the whole series. Yeah.
That's still five individual characters.
And at the moment, Robert Jordan, when he was writing it, nine of them. What was that?
At the moment, there's still nine of them.
Yeah, that's not that big of a deal. Robert Jordan, when he was first writing it, so there's Perrin, Ran, and then what's the other one's name of the three guys from the village? It doesn't matter. Basically,
there's a Tom and a Tam, and that's annoying the hell out of me.
There was going to be another main character, and Robert Jordan wrote it. And apparently the character was really boring because his wife said, "What's the point of this character?" And Jordan said, "Well, he becomes really important in the second and third books." And she said, "Listen, get rid of him, because if he stays, there's not going to be a second or third book."
That's awesome.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah, it's hilarious.
Well, that was my first thoughts is, oh my gosh, there's so many people. And I know this is such a long book or long series. And what have I done? And then finally I got to the point where I was like, okay, I'm okay with this. Yeah. Right now I feel like I'm seeing where all of these other ideas originated from. It feels like a little bit of watching Citizen Kane, where you see shots in that movie that you realize, oh, that's why this has been used in every movie since. And I'm seeing a lot of those tropes, like when they met the gypsy-like people and they're searching for a song. I was like, oh, I'm seeing remnants of or where the whole Name of the Wind concept started. And when they talk about the desert dwellers who are afraid of outsiders and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, I'm seeing where the Demon Saga desert warriors groups originated from. And I'm seeing these other fantasy tropes and cliches that this is where they started. This is where that idea originated in. And so that's fun. I hope that continues. And I hope that doesn't ruin anything for me. Like, I hope that just because I know where this people group in a different book I read goes, it's not exactly echoed from The Wheel of Time.
So, in some ways it might, not necessarily Wheel of Time, but what I've found is the more that I read through old fantasy, the harder sometimes it is to read new fantasy. Mm-hmm. So I know, honestly, Name of the Wind is fantastic and I really love it. But there were a lot of things Patrick Rothfuss kind of like borrowed from older stuff that I recognized as I was reading it. And it doesn't ruin the book, but it kind of pulls you out of the story for a second because you recognize it and you're like, oh, that's from Robin Hobbs, whatever. Or, oh, that's from Robert Jordan. I don't know. And so you start to get like tugged in these different directions, which is a little jarring for the narrative, but it doesn't necessarily ruin it. It just makes it a little harder to stay focused.
Like, homages are fun and awesome and should be done, but if you do it so blatantly and you don't like add anything new to it, then what are you doing? It's not even an homage anymore. You're just redoing something, and that's no fun. That's why I feel like the Wheel of, or not the the Name of the Wind, is a good enough on its own that it reinvents things that the Wheel of Time talks about. It doesn't just use them. It moves on from them a little bit. The same way it does with some things or people have done with Lord of the Rings. That's why there's Tolkien fiction. Like, people don't just lift it completely. They lift it and move on, add more to it so that it's different enough that you can tell that that's obviously a Tolkien elf. However, this one, you know, is a little different because fill in the blank. They're not immortal. They're evil, whatever. As long as you can add something to it, tropes aren't inherently bad. There's nothing wrong with them. It's just if you use them so exactly that the minute I see this character or this thing appear, I know what's coming next or I know how it's going to end, then you've ruined your own book. And that annoys me.
Yeah. I would agree with that. And I'm trying to think of ending tropes, because I would rather have you develop a trope at the beginning of your book, and I can be okay with that as long as the ending of your book is interesting. So sometimes I really wish that American authors would borrow from Russian literature and give me a sad ending. Give me an ending where everything goes to shit and nothing is better. Because we've kind of gotten off on so many happy endings, so many resolutions. And yes, it makes us feel better and it makes us feel fulfilled, I guess. But how many books have you read where you spent, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 books in a series and you get to the end and everything is resolved, but you still feel just empty inside because you spent so much, you know? So you have that feeling anyways. So I wish that an author would just accept that that's how their reader is going to feel and roll with it, you know?
Well, I just finished the latest Chuck Palahniuk book, and he does that every book. Even if there's a positive note at the end, nothing good has been accomplished by the end of the book. It's still usually a very negative ending, even though you feel good. And I don't understand how he does that. The one I just finished was called The Invention of Sound and blew my mind. Like his books always do. They start out about something and end up about something completely different. But I felt the twist coming the whole time in this one. And still at the end, when everything is pretty horrible and there's a very pessimistic worldview from it, you still feel elated and good. And it might just be that you got through it, but I love...
Don't have to do it again.
Yeah, I just love that feeling that I get at the end of every single one of his books where it's like, I just went through hell. And although maybe the big problem was solved, it still doesn't make the world much better that he created. And it feels so real and it feels good to finish books like that instead of you getting so in love with these characters that by the end of it, you're just lost without them.
Sure.
His books give you, like, I don't want to spend much more time with these characters. Even though I kind of want to know what happens next in the world, I understand that it just goes on. It's nihilistic, but somehow uplifting. I don't understand it, but I love it.
The issue I have with Palahniuk is that his books are so, I don't know if depressing is the right word, but they're hard to read. And so you don't really...
Very hard to read.
Yeah, but you don't expect his books to end on a happy note. And no, so no. When they don't, you're just like, okay, that makes sense.
You should try The Invention of Sound. It's pretty short compared to his most other books. I read it in a day, basically. And it is... The times that it gets like incredibly horrible and hard to read are much fewer and further between than his most books.
Okay.
And like all of his books, nothing is what it seems. So you don't even really know what you're reading until you get to the end. And there's a couple times in this book, and I think I sent you a text about one of them, a couple times in this book where he does the same thing that the author I try to get you to read every episode, I feel like now, that Jeff Vandermeer does, where he tells you this incredibly complicated, horrible sometimes thing that happens without ever directly talking about what happened, just giving you the outlines and letting your mind fill in all the salient details, and it makes it so much more poignant. And he does that really, really well with very short, choppy chapters in this book. And yeah, again, it's a really short read. And it's not as dark as most of his other books. So this would be a good introduction to you if you haven't read any Palahniuk. And if you like the feeling it gives you, then read Survivor.
Yikes. So Survivor's definitely a trip. I don't know if you're directing that to me, but I have read Palahniuk. So more what I was getting at is that I want a book that feels like a normal book, that doesn't feel like a Palahniuk book, that feels happy, upbeat, feels like everything is rising to this crescendo of good defeats evil, the farm boy defeats the king, whatever you want to call it, and then it just doesn't happen. Like, the bad guy is victorious, everything goes to hell, and that's it. We don't revive in a second book and go chop Thanos' head off and introduce some time-bending fuckery. I just want to be done. I want to have a book that I have to sit and live with the consequences and really deal with the fact that all of my friends are dead. Because I think that there is...
That would be really fun.
I just think that there's like a space for that in literature, and it's really hard, that's not being filled.
Because like, I'm thinking of a couple that I've read that do that exactly, or do that, you know, in essence. But you can't recommend those after you say that, because then you just know how the book's going to end. And so it's really hard to say that there aren't any of those, because I could think of at least two, maybe three, that do that exact thing. And they were amazing because it was unexpected. And so it doesn't work if I tell you to read them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I appreciate that. And that's really what I want. I just kind of some days wish they were a little more popular, because I remember... Right. I read a book in high school, and it was a short story, but it was written by a Russian, and it was so powerful, and it did not end the way you expected it to. You're reading the entire thing expecting this, I don't know, like you're expecting them to MacGyver a way out of this problem they're in, and it doesn't happen. It's horrifying. The ending is just depressing. And to this day, I still think about that story, like more than I think about most things I read in high school, because it was just so powerful, because they took everything I thought was going to happen and dashed my hopes and dreams against a wall of spikes. It was awesome. Yeah.
I will say that at least two books, at least two of the three books I'm thinking of, I have recommended in the past on this podcast. So if you're reading through our recommendations, there are a couple bummer endings that are surprising and amazing hidden in my recommendations.
Well, joke's on you. I'm still never going to read the books you recommend, even though we keep reading the books we recommend to each other, which is pretty funny.
There's a reason we do them. Well, do you have any other tropes you want to think of, or any other tropes that we think are tropes that aren't used very much?
So we talked about the love triangle. We talked about the farmer becomes king of all creation. We kind of touched on endings. I really do want to talk a little more, if you can think of any, about endings, ending tropes. But I think happy ending is probably the only one that really exists in America. Because there's a story for me.
There's a fantasy trope that gets thrown around a lot, is that the side character is the secret hero. And that one happens, a couple times, and it's really hard to talk about them again without giving everything away. But that one's happened a couple times in recent memory of things that I've read. Where the secret magical power is the side character. And that's what everyone thought before the last Harry Potter book came out was going to happen. Instead, that one went with the friendship is magic, or friendship is the ultimate superpower.
Yeah.
Which is...
So I don't really like the side character being the, like, savior. Because if the side character was the savior, write the book about them, honestly. I don't need the... Because it's almost like a Deus Ex Machina to have the person who's been hanging out the whole time suddenly sweep in out of nowhere and be amazing, even though there wasn't that much foreshadowing to lead us to that point. If you're gonna end a story, I don't mind being surprised, but I want there to be a pretty decent level of foreshadowing that if I was to read the book a second time, I could pick up on it. I don't have to see it the first time, but I want to see it the second time.
That's why I think I really would have liked the final Harry Potter book a lot better if it would have been that twist. Because the whole book series, especially the last book, and the last two books, really, you are shown that Dumbledore and the Order of the Phoenix has been insanely manipulative, and they've been almost as conniving and horrible as the Death Eaters, and you see that they've been doing all of this for a reason, to manipulate Harry into the position he's in so that he has to die so that they can beat Voldemort. However, you also learned three or four books earlier that the same prophecy could have applied to Neville Longbottom, and it would have been, I feel like, more in character with them, because they knew it didn't apply to Harry, but they put Harry front and center all these times so that they could keep their secret weapon in the background, and like was putting the main character of the story in danger all of this time when he wasn't even the prophesied one. Like, that would have been such an interesting twist, and it would have played on the building animosity towards the good guys that he has the whole last couple books. That would have been fun and would have been very unexpected. I mean, it was expected by the before the book came out, people were talking about that's how they think it's going to end. And I think it would have been a little bit more fun if she did it that way.
After watching the movies, I can understand that completely. And I get how that would have been kind of fun to watch.
Would have been interesting.
So, I wouldn't disagree with you on that.
I don't know how well either of them, I mean, it would have turned out. Obviously, that's an alternate reality, but I think that would have been more fun for me reading the books if that happened. The concept of like the friendship is magic. The reason I will always prevail over you is because I'm not alone, is really annoying to me. I don't know why. I just want, I like the, maybe it's because I'm antisocial and kind of.
What? You? Nah.
What's the word? Not outgoing.
Introverted?
Yes. Since I'm more introverted most of the time, I think I like the idea of a solitary hero that doesn't, and going up against overwhelming odds. And usually yeah. that's how they portray it, but then the bad guy is just one person. And the power of friendship is what wins it. And I understand that you have to have multiple characters to make a book, but some of my favorite books are the ones that are a single person is the main character and they're facing adversity or whatever.
Yeah.
I wish that.
I think that like that storyline in books is what made me an introvert. If you follow the idea that nurture over nature, because in most of my favorite books, you have like one person who can do everything by themselves and doesn't need anyone else. And they're able to do everything and save the world. And that probably screwed me over a little bit because growing up in my formative years, I was like, yeah, screw other people. They're stupid. I can do it all. Whoops.
But yeah, anymore, that is, I mean, even if you have the lone wanderer trope character, he's never actually a lone wanderer. Look at all the big shows and movies that have come out in the last just 2 years that have been the super powerful lone wanderer badass character. John Wick yeah. and The Mandalorian, and help me out here, I'm missing one of the main ones, aren't I?
I don't know. Iron Man.
Yeah. not Iron Man. That one doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
But yeah, those two movies are all about this one, or those two things are all about this one badass, super powerful character that in The Mandalorian, every single episode, he's making a new best friend that helps him out of a jam. Like literally that's the whole point of the show. And I don't like the show and, you know, at me at that, I don't care.
Oh, hey, hold up. Can we just spend the next 20 minutes shitting on The Mandalorian? Cause I could be down for that.
Possibly, but we might have to take a side episode on that.
That's fine.
And then John Wick is this badass. He can kill everyone, every single assassin. But all three movies are him looking for more people to help him. And each movie since the first one has had some stunt cast assistant that helps him out when he actually gets to a jam. And it's just like there's no such thing as the lone wanderer superpowered badass anymore. And there may never have been. Like, let's look back in The Road Warrior and Mad Max. His whole thing is that he goes and ends up saving some village and he gets help from a guy who has a flying vehicle and or he saves a bunch of concubines and him and the badass woman who's got her arm chopped off save the world. And it's just it's framed as this one super powerful wanderer character, but it's never the reality. It's always they have so much help and it's really friendship is magic powers. And that's annoying to me.
That's totally fair.
If you're going to have a lone wanderer badass, then actually make him a lone wanderer badass. Don't give him a bunch of supporting cast.
I think your actual problem that you have is that the side characters are Deus Ex Machinas.
Yeah, in a lot of cases.
Well, no, I think that's what I think that's what a lot of writers do. They feel like they're avoiding a Deus Ex Machina because they're giving their Machine of the Gods a voice and characterization, but that doesn't necessarily take that trope away if you're just allowing them to solve the problem. Right. And that's one of the reasons why those characters fall flat or why the book might not ring true, because you have this character and it's following you around, and realistically, it's not a character at that point. It's just like a doomsday device that you can mm-hmm. trigger whenever you need to fix the problem. And that's unsatisfying.
Yeah. And you just know it's happening every like beat for beat. Like, okay, massive spoiler for The Mandalorian. But the last episode, when Grogu, Baby Yoda gets taken or whatever, there's this huge fight and it keeps getting worse and worse. And they keep having this moments where more and more stormtroopers are piling out. But then Boba Fett disappears. And I'm like, oh, he's going to show up in 30 seconds and he's going to kill them all. And Boba Fett has been introduced as an antagonist at the beginning of this episode, which, again, why are the episodes only like 30 minutes long? That was like 30 minutes ago. He was a bad guy. Nope, he's going to come out and he's going to save the day. And I said that, and 5 seconds later, he comes out and he saves the day. And it's just, That's exactly what the IG-88 droid did in the first season. That's exactly what the now police cop MMA fighter chick did in the other episode. That's exactly what his bounty hunter boss did like three times in the previous season. It's, oh, he's going to have one of his random new best friends save the day. And it's just so boring. Like, if I know exactly what's going to happen beat for beat, why am I watching this show?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just not a good, it's not good writing at that point.
Yeah.
And I think that someone needs to develop a pithy term like Deus Ex Machina to describe a side character that solves all your problems. So people stop doing it.
Yeah. Quit with that trope. Give us actual character growth in our characters. And
yes,
if you're going to do a cliche, do it like interesting. Like, I don't know why, as we said, we talked about how the good and the bad of the love triangle, there is a way you can do it great and there's a way you can do it horrible. It just, I don't know. This has just been a bunch of ranting about tropes. I don't know.
I thought that was the whole purpose of this episode.
It was.
Did I show up to the wrong podcast?
No. I just feel like often at the end of episodes, I want to have some like concluding statement, like I'm writing a research paper. This isn't a research paper. This is us just bullshitting into a microphone.
Yeah, this is just an excuse for us to talk about stuff that no one else will talk with us about. Please.
Exactly. Speaking of, neither of us did our reading, so if you're holding out for an hour into this podcast for us to talk about Out of the Silent Planet, oops.
You're going to be real disappointed, guys.
We might, if we both have a free time later this week, which I personally doubt it for myself, we might record a 10-minute catch up on what happened outside the planet and tack it onto this before next Monday. But I wouldn't hold your fingers on that. Hold your fingers, yeah, cross your fingers.
That's fine. It sounds like Tomorrow Me's problem, and that guy sucks.
Yeah, that guy, fuck him.
Amen.
yeah. Well, anything else you want to mention?
No, not really. I think we covered it all. Tropes are bad. Writers are stupid.
Don't watch The Mandalorian.
Perfect. Perfect.
All right. Well, we'll see y'all next time. Look for us on Twitter at @book_pod, Facebook at @BookReportPodcast, Instagram at @TheBookReportPod with dashes in between everything. And if you want to email us at bookreportpod@gmail.com. Steven, I think I want to do another writing project for over the Christmas break because I think we're probably going to take a couple weeks off for Christmas stuff. Do you have a writing prompt queued up? Do you want to give me?
For you? Yes, yeah. I do.
You do? Okay, I have one too.
Okay. So, I'll go first.
Okay.
I'm going to let you write sci-fi because I'm kind and I love you. Yay. I won't write a research paper
this time.
Thank God. Ugh. All right. I want you to write your take on, do you know what the paperclip apocalypse is?
I do not know what the paperclip apocalypse is.
Okay, it's basically the idea that an AI, an artificial intelligence, would destroy the world because it was tasked with creating paperclips, and it diverts all of the world's resources to creating paperclips.
I've never heard that, but interesting.
Yeah, feel free to research it. It's you'll find it if you just Google paperclip apocalypse. And I want to see what your take on that is.
Okay. That is so broad. I hate you.
Yeah, it is. Do you want me to narrow it down?
If you could narrow it down at all, that would be helpful.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead and tell me yours, and then I'll think how I can narrow it down a little bit.
Okay. Okay, mine's going to be equally broad because you gave me a broad one. I'm about to narrow it down. This one's fairly narrowed down from what you gave me.
Oh, my God.
Okay. I want you to tell me about a completely normal event from a non-human point of view. So an inanimate object, an animal, an alien, a fairy, demon, something.
Ooh,
just not human.
I can finally write furry porn. Okay. Continue.
But tell me about a normal event from a non-human point of view in a way that makes it bizarre. Do not explain the event or what you, the POV character, are, but give me enough context to try to guess at both of those things.
Do you want to be able to guess successfully, or do you want me to write it like,
I mean, really don't write it so esoterically that it could be anything, but like it shouldn't be super easy, but we should be able to figure out what it is.
Okay. Okay. You'll have to write this down. This is like,
yeah, kind of complex, I have it written down.
I can do that.
I'll email that to you.
Okay. So to narrow yours down, so I want you to write it from the perspective of the AI who slowly realizes that he is destroying the world that created him by creating.
Okay. That's fun. Yeah.
Does that work for you?
Okay, write that up. I'll email you mine, you email yours, and I'll put it in the episode description of this episode. And that will be our next episode. That might be sometime after Christmas because everything's crazy at this time of year.
Christmas is hard. Yep.
All right. Yep. Bye.
Hitter hitters.